We begin on campus, where UNC officials say they finally wrapped up testing for lead in sinks and drinking fountains, a process that began with a summer science project and ultimately led the university to take hundreds of water fixtures offline. With more on the lessons learned and where things go from here, here's 97.9 The Hill's Brighton McConnell.
The first official notice of lead in a campus water fixture came on September 1st. After tests taken from historic drinking fountains in Wilson Library came back with noticeably high levels of lead. The toxic metal is not safe at any level of exposure, but the Environmental Protection Agency does not have any regular testing requirements for universities, and it typically requires a significant amount of lead to be ingested for health problems. Rebecca Fry, an environmental sciences professor at UNC with an expertise in toxicology, says when she heard about the lead last year, she wasn't stunned.
Of course, I was concerned, but not surprised. Not surprised because metals are everywhere in the environment. And while we have found it here, I'm quite certain that if other universities looked for lead in drinking water, they also would find it.
Fry served as an advisor to the university in its subsequent testing efforts, which included taking water samples from every drinking fountain, bottle filler, and sink on campus. The results saw more than 100 university buildings with at least one fixture testing with traces of lead, which were then taken offline and are slated to be replaced. Fry says part of the volume of these results can be attributed to UNC having an aggressive strategy to identify problematic fixtures. She describes the effort as a two-day process for each facility tested, as water is flushed the night before from the fixture before two consecutive measurements are gathered.
Before a sample's collected, water has to be released from the system, and then early the next morning, samples are collected. And so when the testing started, that was through the enormous efforts of environmental health safety, and then we brought in some students to help. And then we brought in contractors because this was a lot of work.
To gather those samples and send them off to a state lab for testing, a group of student volunteers aided the university team for a handful of hours each week. Some of those students came from Fry's lab, who says it provided an excellent opportunity for hands-on work in the field.
I've had students who participated in that testing tell me that it is the most impactful thing that has happened during their 4 years of being here and really transformed their lives. So several of the students were so impacted by that, you know, that they're talking about going into careers in environmental science.
To accommodate and assuage campus community members concerned about lead exposure, UNC offered free blood lead level tests during the last 7 months. Fry says that everyone who took a test had their blood come back with lead levels in the reference range, or with normal amounts. That is an encouraging sign, as the university waits for more analysis of the water sample's data to determine any broader patterns of lead presence on campus. Fry adds that one of the most obvious patterns already seen is lead was far more prevalent in UNC's older buildings than its newer ones, which made for much higher traces during the first months of testing.
From looking at the results over time, of course, we did this testing in a phased approach where the earliest phases were focused on our oldest buildings on campus. And so certainly some of those early data points came back higher than the later data points, which were collected from our newer buildings on campus.
As seen by the dozens of buildings and hundreds of fixtures with high lead levels, though, UNC's response to the toxic metal will be more layered than just replacing old parts. The university said it will begin testing its older buildings every 3 years for lead, which Fry says she believes is, quote, a good plan. Additionally, the Environment, Health, and Safety Department will test drinking fixtures that previously had lead levels 1 year at the latest after their replacement. For the full list of UNC facilities and fixtures that returned tests with traces of lead, visit chapelboro.com. For 97.9 The Hill, I'm Brighton McConnell.
Tonight's a busy night for local government meetings, beginning with the Chapel Hill Town Council. They're gathering at 6:30 in the Chapel Hill Public Library for a work session on the complete community housing proposal, which would allow for more housing density in town, including duplexes, triplexes, and accessory apartments. That's just a work session. The council will not be taking any action tonight. Meanwhile, the Hillsborough Town Board meets at 7 o'clock. Their agenda includes a discussion of a popular fundraiser event that wants to close a block of Eno Street in June, town staff pushing back a little bit against that request. The Orange County School Board also meets tonight at 7. They'll vote on a budget request for next year. In Chatham County, the Pittsburgh Town Board will meet at 7 to consider approving an update to the town's system development fee, attempting to recoup from developers the cost of providing town services to new developments. And in Durham, county commissioners will meet at 7 with an agenda that includes a public hearing on the county's stormwater ordinance. Get links to all those agendas on our website, chapelborough.com. Speaking of local government, 97.9 The Hill's Andrew Stuckey spoke last week with Chapel Hill's first ever diversity, equity, and inclusion officer, Shanika Weeks, who's working now on a countywide racial equity framework called One Orange. Here's part of what she had to say about the office.
We understand from the foundation of America, and it's an amazing place, but it wasn't built with everyone in mind, right? And so the work that local jurisdictions and government has to do is to look at the ways in which our policies, our programs are situated, and the ways in which those programs and policies and procedures really perpetuate inequities in our community. We really want to make sure the mission of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Office is to uncover and address implicit racial biases in our institutions and to ensure that race can no longer be used to predict life outcomes in our community, right? And so the way in which we do that is certainly normalizing conversations around race, organizing some internal infrastructure, making sure that we have places and spaces within our town where people can come learn to use racial equity tools to ask better questions, get better answers that lead to better outcomes in the community. And then again, looking at those strategies and bringing the community in with us to have them help us figure out what it is that we can do better.
And Shanika Weeks speaking there. You can get the full conversation in the News on the Hill section of our website, chapelborough.com. Turning to business news, we learned over the weekend that the building housing Mama Dip's restaurant has been listed for sale in downtown Chapel Hill. It's a 4,200-square-foot building on West Rosemary Street. LoopNet has it listed for $3.6 million. So if you have $3.6 million, they've got a building for sale. No word on the future of the restaurant itself, but a family member said on Facebook that Mama Dip's is not for sale, just the building. The restaurant business is a tough one in general. That's even true for the establishments that some might call North Carolina's most iconic, talking about wood-cooked barbecue joints. A number of famous spots have shut down in recent years, and Carolina Connection's Christian Phillips recently tried to find out why.
It's a Saturday afternoon at Grady's Barbecue Restaurant in Dudley, just a few miles south of Goldsboro, and the line in the modest dining room is almost out the door. And there's a good reason why. Steve and Jerry Grady have been cooking and running their restaurant for 36 years, always cooking on wood.
I never used gas, but I don't think prior to two of them. Wood is so much smoother, like.
While many often cite the foolproof taste test when it comes to determining that wood is the best way to cook barbecue due to its enhanced smoky flavor, there's actually a scientific component, according to the head extension meat science specialist at NC State University, Dana Hansen.
That consumption of that organic material that we know as wood produces a number of compounds that are not produced when you burn gas. So that's where the art and science kind of come together with barbecue, is knowing how to manage a fire to get that really good smoky flavor, color, and aroma.
The disappearance of wood cooking barbecue restaurants is also a symbol of the changing times in North Carolina, both for the population and the economy. While some newer restaurants are opening in urban districts, they tend to cook with gas, and smaller, more rural restaurants are struggling to stay open due to the changing dynamics of the state.
Barbecue restaurants in general that use wood have been on the decline for 10, 15 years. The trend line is going down.
Another factor in the decline of the restaurants is how labor and time-intensive cooking barbecue is using wood rather than gas. Keith Allen was in the barbecue industry for decades. His Chapel Hill restaurant, Allen & Son, used to be a staple of North Carolina barbecue. However, back in 2018, he closed the restaurant.
It was time. It was 48 years long enough in one spot. I had other stuff to do, but I hated to go, but I needed to move on.
Alan would usually wake up at 2 a.m. to get the fire going and cook from there.
2 hours burning before, 2 hours burning after, fire goes out, 8 hours worth of cooking. Firing every 30 minutes for 8 hours.
Alan was not alone in how long he would be cooking, according to Hansen and Grady.
That is not an 8-to-5 job. I mean, it's not, never has been. And that 15-hour day plus and physical labor of doing those kind of things like chopping wood and maintaining a wood pile and burning fire and getting up at God knows what hour to stoke the fire to cook pigs for the next day, there's better options.
You need about 7 or 8 hours. Sometimes it don't never end. One day to the next.
Besides the work, there are economic factors that are hurting the barbecue industry, according to Hansen.
Pork prices are at historic highs right now. I mean, and that is also the case for if you're building a plate of barbecue, just about everything that you can think of. Coleslaw, hush puppies, boiled potatoes, Texas Pete, cheer wine. All those things that make a plate of barbecue are all going up.
Alan got into the barbecue business to follow in his dad's footsteps, as did Steve Grady, who followed both his grandfather and father into the profession. This trend has also become less common in the industry, as children who once would take over after their parents retired have moved on to other professions.
Used to, you know, a community would be built around a family or two or three families, and that family would carry on the businesses. But now the kids and grandkids got different choices to make and can make. Jobs are good.
The future of wood-cooked barbecue in North Carolina may be in jeopardy, but two things will always remain true, that barbecue has played a major part in our state's history and is a major part of our culture. Reporting from Dudley, I'm Christian Phillips.
Carolina Connection, a student-produced radio newscast from the UNC Husband School of Journalism and Media that airs at 8:30 on Saturday mornings on 97.9 The Kill. And visit our website, chapelboro.com, for even more local news, including a piece from the Chatham News and Record marking the 10-year anniversary of the rebuilding of the historic Pittsboro Courthouse after a devastating fire in March of 2010. Time is 6:22. Time now for sports, brought to you this hour by Inside Carolina. Big transfer news over the weekend as former UNC basketball players Caleb Love and Dontrez Styles announced their new destinations. Styles is headed to D.C. to play for Georgetown, and Love is headed north to play for Michigan. Tar Heels could face Caleb Love in a Wolverines uniform this November, as both teams are headed to the Bahamas to play in the battle for Atlantis. On the field, the fifth-ranked Tar Heel women's lacrosse team beat Pitt on a rainy Friday, 16-3. Marissa Wright had 6 goals and Riley Casey had 4 to lead the way. Not as good a day for the UNC men, though, as the 9th-ranked Tar Heels fell to number 3 Virginia, 19-12. Women are back in action tomorrow at ECU. The men's next game is Saturday against Syracuse. Elsewhere, 13th-ranked Carolina baseball won their 4th straight ACC series over the weekend. They split a doubleheader with Georgia Tech on Friday to take the series 2-1. Now just a half game out of first place in the Coastal Division, the Heels are back in action tomorrow night hosting Queens before a 3-game set against Miami this weekend. UNC softball also had a good weekend, sweeping a doubleheader against Pitt on Sunday. Lily Bax got the win on the mound in both of those games as UNC won 10-6 and 3-0. On the court, the top-ranked Tar Heel women's tennis team shut out Wake Forest on Saturday, though the men lost to Duke 5-2. In hockey, the Carolina Hurricanes lost to Buffalo on Saturday 4-3. They're back in action tonight at Ottawa starting at 7 p.m. And back to baseball, the Durham Bulls lost to Jacksonville on Friday and Sunday after taking the first 3 games of that road series. Still won the series 3-2. Saturday's game was rained out. The Bulls are back home this week. They're hosting Lehigh Valley starting tomorrow night.